Edward Wyatt versus Commonwealth, James C. Martin for appellant, Aaron Campbell for appellee. Mr. Martin, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please, Your Honor.
Okay. You may proceed.
I'm James Martin, or Jim Martin, from Martin & Martin Law Firm in Danville. I'm appearing on the appeal of Michael Edward Wyatt, which is from Pennsylvania County. Not exactly a paradise for defendants either. He got 25 years active on these charges, and I believe he has some time, some other cases from Danville. But there are 8 assignments of error. I apologize to the court on the number, but I think they're all pretty much self-explanatory unless the court has some questions, except for number 7. That is one that was originally the only issue granted per curiam, and then we had another panel, or partially another panel, that granted all of the issues except the bond issue that was number 9. We submit that the facts in this case indicate that there were 69 stolen items taken in this burglary, worth about a total of $30,000. The defendant was found with 4 rings in his possession, not at the location of the break-in, in the general community. I believe it was actually in the city of Danville, but you know, Pennsylvania and Danville are right there together. It wasn't that far away. He claimed that he had found these rings in a dumpster, and obviously the trial of fact did not believe that. We've stated our objections to sufficiency in arguments 5 and 6, but I think it's relevant to number 7, which is possession of a firearm as a violent felon.
The Commonwealth's argument is because he had several of the items stolen from the burglary, he must have stolen all of them by himself, including the firearms.
I believe that is the Commonwealth's argument. And what I'm saying is that's piling an inference upon an inference. I mean, Bright versus Commonwealth in 4 Virginia appellate. I don't know the page number, but that was one of my favorite cases when I was a prosecutor, because it's a permissible inference of burglary from larceny, from recent possession. And that's what they're trying to do here.
We've got that, don't we? I mean, we not only have the recent possession, or the possession of recently stolen goods, but we've got such things as flight, which the court can infer.
The court can infer that. I'm not in a position to concede that because of the issues 5 and 6, but for purposes of 7, yes, we do have that. Arguendo, recent possession of 4 rings, and I think Your Honor has stated it properly, that they are inferring that he must have stolen the whole thing by himself,
the
all these items.
The inference that seems a little weak is the inference that he was the sole burglar.
Right, and we don't know specifically whether he was or not. I don't think anyone else was charged, but I submit it's speculative to think that he was the only person. A case that I don't think was mentioned in any of the briefs was Blake versus Commonwealth, 15 Virginia Appellate 706. That's one that the Commonwealth won on appeal on constructive possession based on some conversations between defendants. One of them used the firearm and one didn't, but they were having some conversations. There's any number of cases like that where the Commonwealth wins, but because of a specific factual scenario that allows them to pile that second inference onto the Bright inference, or the permissible inference of burglary from larceny, to pile constructive possession onto that. And the way they do it is could be any number of ways, because constructive possession is pretty open-ended, that you can prove it any number of ways. We submit that it has not been proven here, and that it's an inference piled upon an inference.
Is an inference based on the inference a clear error?
Well, it's something that you hear about a lot in the law. I don't know that there's a case that says, you know, if you make two inferences that...
I don't think we have one in Virginia, but I think there is perhaps some authority that speaks to the issue, and I don't think it's Bright, though, Bright versus Conwell.
No, it wouldn't be Bright, because it didn't really deal with that. It was affirming the conviction and saying, you know, inferring a larceny.
It's old.
And in burglary.
It's old evidentiary treatises, perhaps. You may have found something like that.
That's where I've seen it. I do not have a case, and unfortunately, that says, and I doubt it would say, you know, when we get to the second inference, it's not guilty. I mean, it's a way of explaining how tenuous the connection here is. I don't think it's a specific doctrine. It's not per se error.
Then isn't that then up to the trier of fact to determine whether it's enough of an improper inference given the circumstances of the case?
Normally it would be, but I would submit that there's absolutely no evidence here that he was the sole burglar. Yes, there were some.
There's no evidence there was anybody else. And that's circumstantial. You have to have some evidence to support something.
Right.
That can't come out of the imagination of the defendant.
That's correct, but I mean he did say that he found him in the dumpster, and
right,
you know
that's
been rejected for purposes of other assignments of error, but I think the Commonwealth has to have some modicum to get to the beyond reasonable doubt.
The evidence is unrebutted that all of the items were stolen from the same larceny, same burglary. Isn't that correct? I mean, didn't
that the right there? Well, there's no evidence that any of them were stolen.
Came home and found
otherwise.
All the stuff gone at the same time.
That's correct, and so that's how you get the normal inference of burglary, which is a permissible inference.
So, if we conclude that the evidence is sufficient to support the inference that he was the burglar, the only thing we're lacking is whether he was the sole burglar.
Well, we're lacking whether he was the sole burglar, and if he...
Okay, let me stop you.
Yeah.
If he were a joint burglar, would he be guilty, and the other person is the one that actually took possession of the firearms and took them out, would he be in constructive possession?
It would just depend on the facts of what indicated his knowledge. This is not, of course, a use of a firearm charge, as the court knows that that's way different in purpose and intent, and you know you can have a fake gun through the pocket and things like that. But the gravamen of this offense is it's personal. I would submit to the accused that you know he either physically possessed this or there's some concrete evidence of constructive possession, like conversations between defendants. Somebody saw him looking over at that. There was, a co-defendant was conversing with the victim and mentioning some kind of a gun. None of that we have here, so I submit we can certainly conjure up scenarios where that would be applicable. I would just submit on his behalf that it's not applicable here, and again, the inference on inference is a way of explaining that, and so we would just submit that ought to be reversed. And in addition to the other arguments that we have, so if the court affirms on argument 6, we still get to all this. Number 5 is, you know, the grand larceny, and again he said that it was, found in a dumpster. We have some other assignments of error, you know, everything from juror misconduct, knowledge of the case, a little conversation at a Christmas breakfast that is our first assignment of error. We have number 3 and 4 that have to do with the circumstances of the defendant's capture.
Mr. Martin, I want to ask you specifically about your assignments of error 2, 3, 4, and 5. Each of those assignments of error carries with it a one or two, at maximum three sentence argument on the merits. No legal argument, no citation to cases, nothing other than a conclusory statement. Are those really serious assignments of error that you're presenting to us?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that they're, with respect, I think they're all serious assignments of error.
Well, if they're serious assignments of error, why couldn't you do us the favor of doing some legal research and make a legal argument in support of those assignments of error?
Well,
because I know there's case law on some of these issues, actually not in your favor, but I know there's case law out there. And it seems to me that you are treading perilously close to the rule that requires you to be candid with the tribunal and present only to us meritorious claims.
Well, I'm not aware of cases absolutely on point that would control these, and I apologize to the court if I have not found any of those.
Well, let's talk a moment about your assignment of error as to whether or not the court should tell the jury that the sentences would be consecutive. Isn't there a multitude of cases that say that a trial judge's response to that kind of question is you should sentence the jury according to your conscience and not concern yourself as to what happens thereafter?
I don't have those cases specifically. I believe there are cases, basically along those lines.
There are cases that say that.
I understand, Your Honor, and I'm trying to present, go without going over the cliff of frivolousness. I'm trying to present what Mr. Wyatt wants to present.
Then in that case, you have an obligation to your client, a zealous representation.
Right.
Or if he insists on proceeding, you have an obligation to present it in the nature of an Anders argument.
Right. I don't know, and with all respect, I don't know if it's possible to combine the Anders brief with the other kind. I certainly will look into that in the future, and I certainly appreciate what Your Honor's saying, but I really don't know how to do that. Maybe it could be done assignment of error by assignment of error. I don't know. I don't know how to do that.
I will end the discussion with simply a comment that this court doesn't exist to do lawyers' legal research on their own, on their behalf.
Yes,
so,
sir.
If you have arguments that you wish us to actually consider and decide, please give us the basis that supports that argument.
Yes, sir.
You're into your rebuttal, and I'll give you a little extra.
Well, thank you. I just ask that the court consider the matters I've stated. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Campbell.
Good morning. May it please the court, Aaron Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. I will follow Mr. Martin's lead, and unless the court has any questions, I will just focus on issue number 7.
That seems to be the significant question.
Yeah, and it's an interesting issue, and quite frankly, I have not found a case like this at all. I mean, typically when we talk about possession of a firearm, we're talking about two circumstances. The defendant is seen with the firearm, but the firearm isn't recovered, or conversely, the defendant or the firearm is recovered, but the defendant is not seen with the firearm. In this case, he's not seen with the firearm, and the firearms are not recovered. But the trier of fact, who was in this one issue, was the trial court, said, "Well, wait a minute. The evidence shows that he's the one that stole the firearms. Therefore, he must have possessed the firearms."
Well, he's the one that committed the burglary. I'm not sure there's any finding. There's a finding that over $200 worth of property was stolen during the burglary and that he was a participant in the burglary. I mean, isn't that about as far as we can stretch it?
I mean, if the evidence is sufficient that he committed the burglary, then I think the evidence is sufficient that he's stole from the hole. He stole.
Stole the hole?
Stole the hole.
Well, then there's case law on that generic proposition.
Yeah, and the inference upon an inference rule, I guess, for lack of a better term. And I didn't cite this case in my brief, but it came up upon my research after I wrote my brief. And it's from this court. It's Johnson v. Commonwealth. It's 15 Virginia App 73, decided in 1992, opinion by Judge Elder. And it's actually a burglary case in which the defendant had raised the issue of this being an inference upon inference. And Judge Elder wrote that the rule appellant has relied upon in making his argument is not absolute. In fact, it has been said that there is no rule of law which prohibits basing an inference or presumption upon another inference or presumption. And he cites to a friend on evidence.
Well, he did all the research for us, Judge Elder. Good for him.
Yeah, and then he goes on to say the court has held that the true rule is that all the facts proved in the case, whether by direct or circumstantial evidence, may serve as a basis to which further inferences may a fact may be drawn.
Well, that's it. An inference is simply a circumstantial, a species of circumstantial
yeah.
evidence. If there's footprints in the snow, you can infer somebody walked through the snow.
Yeah.
But here, are we carrying that is it a necessary conclusion that if someone participates in a burglary, he is the only one participating in the burglary?
Well, there's no evidence in this record to suggest that there was another person.
There's some fingerprints that may or may not belong to the wife.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. There was a fingerprint on the gun case that the wife could not be excluded as. So we don't know whose fingerprint that actually was. It could have been the wife's. But otherwise, there's no evidence for a fact finder to draw that another person participated in this burglary. In fact, that argument was raised at trial court, and the trial court rejected it. But even if there was another person involved, I mean, there are plenty of cases that talk about possession of a firearm does not have to be exclusive. It can be joint. So I don't see why not that if this other person participated in taking these 15 firearms, that the appellant could be found guilty of also being in joint possession of those firearms.
Well, there seems to be no question about the evidence that both the rings and the firearms were taken at the same time.
Yes.
Which I think is not an insignificant piece of evidence. Otherwise, you probably would never get to the inference of the guns.
Right. In fact, some of the guns were in the same room as the.
Yeah, they were definitely taken, right? That's the evidence.
Yes.
Nothing that rebutted it or contradicted it. And then I think you do proceed with one principle of law that just because the quantity of goods was less than the quantity of goods taken at the time of the theft, let's say,
yeah.
doesn't mean you can't charge someone for the theft of all of the goods. I mean, we have a case on that. So
yeah.
That's sort of generic. Henderson.
Yeah.
Supreme Court. The only analogy I can come up with is let's assume that the evidence is there was $300 taken from my night table drawer.
Yeah.
And the defendant is found in possession of $250 right outside, well, let's say in the neighborhood.
Right.
I'm not sure we'd be saying you can't infer that, assuming people believe, that the jurors believe that $300 was in fact in the night table drawer, couldn't infer that just because only $250 was on the perpetrator's body, so to speak, in his possession, that it wasn't the whole amount.
Right.
If this were all the same genre, let's assume, you know, seven rings were taken as opposed to, what is this, four here, five,
four.
Wife testifies she had seven rings there, but only four were found on this defendant. I'm not sure we'd be having the same difficulties in inferring that this individual took all of them.
And I agree. I think it's a...
It's the fact that it's a firearm.
It's the fact that it's a possession of a firearm charge that gives, I think, everyone pause that it's unusual.
But unusual.
Yes.
But
maybe that's the wrong focus, is all I'm trying to say in a not very artful way.
Yeah.
If the focus is not the genre of the property, many of the principles of law that we're quite familiar with would apply.
I mean, I could come up with a hypothetical where maybe this doesn't work. Say the defendant stole a truck with merchandise, and inside that truck was hidden a firearm, and they find the defendant selling the merchandise. Probably not going to be able to convict him of the possession of the firearm if he had no idea about that firearm that was in the truck. But here, we can infer that he was one of the participants that stole these firearms.
Well, everything was in the same place.
Yes.
I think that's a hard fact to get around. I don't know that it's enough, but it's something that I think that deserves some weight.
Yeah, and I would just say, and I'll cite again from Judge Elder's case that I cited to you earlier. He does talk about the familiar principle that it's within the province of the jury to determine what inferences are drawn from the proof facts, provided the inferences are reasonably related to those facts. You know, it's an unusual case, but I think the court's decision is rational. And if there's no other questions, I'd ask that the court just affirm on all the issues.
Thank you very much. Mr. Martin, you have about 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
There was a, talk about the fingerprints, there was a certificate of analysis that, you know, they didn't find anything. But I think it is true that the people were in the house were printed. This was Appendix 457 and 58 that's the testimony talking about it. But anyway,
let me ask you about Judge Annunziata's observation and get your response. If there is a burglary in which $500 worth of property is taken all at the same time, and the defendant is soon thereafter found in possession of $50 worth of that merchandise, do you agree that he could be convicted of grand larceny, that our inference that the possession of recently stolen goods leads to the inference that he's the thief?
That could happen, yes. Okay. I mean, that would be
so
a permissible thing.
Why doesn't that inference, that conclusion apply here? He's in possession of some of the property, so it is logical to conclude that he stole all the property.
Well, I think it doesn't apply here because there's 69 items totaling $30,000. I think, I'm sure there's a gray area in there somewhere, but I think, you know, including, frankly, 15 firearms. I mean, it's highly likely that somebody had to help him do this.
I don't think he had a big bag.
I don't know if he had a big bag, but, you know, four little rings were found on him when they arrested him, I believe, on something else. And it you know, it was not like four huge items. It was four little rings. And so I think that I would respectfully submit that that's inapplicable here. I just would submit that we're not here on hypotheticals. We're not here whether it could be a joint possession. You know, yes, there could be joint possession of, you know, 15 firearms, 69 items, $30,000 worth of stuff. I mean, it's highly likely that there was, if there were more than one person, that there was such joint possession. But if one guy's taking stuff out the front and one guy's taking stuff out the back and he doesn't have any knowledge of the firearm, he's guilty of the use of a firearm in that burglary. But I submit he's not guilty of possession of a firearm as a convicted felon, which is a thing that's personal to him and requires the additional step of constructive possession. And thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Martin. We have Greek Council.